Welcome to Gonkcast, an Autechr podcast. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is another bonus episode about your emails. We had to skip our last bonus episode, so we've got a nice big backlog of emails to get to today. We're also going to spend some time discussing the 2008 Autechr live set recently reconstructed by We Are the Music Makers users iOS and Digit. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, we're going to explain everything in just a minute, and trust me, you want to hear this. First, though, I want to say thank you to everyone who's written in over the past few weeks. Even if it takes me a while to respond, I read everything right away and with great excitement, so do keep them coming. Gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Our next episode will be on oversteps and move of 10, and we really haven't heard from too many of you yet, so send us your thoughts. Again, that's gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Contact info is in the show notes, and be sure to leave us a 5-star rate and review while you're there. Okay, Dan, why don't you explain what this live set reconstruction is for anyone out of the loop?
Yeah, back in 2018, Autechr randomly added the system files for their 2008 tour to their online store. There was no announcement about this, and the free download links were quite hidden. When the dedicated AE fans on the We Are the Music Makers forums found them, they realized all these celebrated live sets could be heard in soundboard quality for the first time if only somebody had the right gear, that being Electron's Mono Machine and Machine Drum, the Nord Modular G2 and MPC 1000. As well as a lot of patience. In stepped two users, iOS and Digit, who spent 2 years getting every little detail right using a crowd bootleg of Autechr's April 4th set at the LA Echoplex as their guide. And in December of 2020, they finally finished and shared their hard work with Autechr's fans everywhere. You'll find the link in the show notes of the episode.
Yeah, let's start with the set itself. What did you think of it in this gloriously perfect quality?
Well, you know, I mean, when I saw that they were doing this, you know, I didn't really have high hope. You know, it, being a fan thing, I didn't think it was going to be anything, you know, too awesome. But damn, it's really, really great.
Yeah, I mean, but like the music itself. I mean, what do you think of this set? I know that this, like, is particular this show at the Echoplex is, you know, the bootleg is pretty celebrated as kind of a classic AE bootleg.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I mean, it sounds like a ton of fun. You know, I think I've mentioned it before. I went to one of the Autechr shows, one of the ones that's in the AE Live sets, and it was like, I enjoyed it a lot, but it wasn't like, no one was dancing. It wasn't like a, you know, an upbeat kind of thing. But this sounds like it would be, you know, like, it seems like something like very fun to dance and move around to, but also, I mean, you know, still crazy and like experimental in that, you know, Autechr kind of way. It's like a perfect mix of the Quaristus era and like you know, being in a club, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's funny, actually, you know, I'm always reading the Ask Autechr Anything from 2013. I'm going to be real sad when we go beyond that and it's no longer relevant. But, you know, I'm always reading it, and I've noticed that, like, there are a lot of little comments and jokes about how Americans don't dance to Autechr, but I guess UK fans do. And they're, like, always giving these little snide remarks about, like, I don't know why the fuck Americans don't dance, but they just don't. So I don't know what the deal is. It's hard, still hard for me to imagine dancing to the AE live sets, but you're right. This one is like, it's a lot of fun. I mean, what was interesting to me is that, you know, I kind of wanted to ask you, like, what do you think they're doing with the chorus to sound? Since, as we were saying, it's like their live sets are always this kind of look at them, you know, moving towards something. Usually it's like the thing that fills in the gaps between these big changes. But I was surprised to hear that it really sounds like Choristus, you know? It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like not like a wild departure. It's like them jamming and like making this delightfully fun live set out of the Choristus sounds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because you're right, you know, the other live stuff I've heard, you know, the AE Live and everything, none of it really like sounds exactly like, you know, whatever album just came out or you know, that era. But this kind of does it. It really just sounds like jamming with those, you know, I don't want to say presets, but, you know, sort of like the presets of the Choristus album or, you know, the instruments or layouts, whatever, of that time period.
Yeah. And it doesn't like tell us, I think, anything about oversteps, you know,
there's no hint
whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it's so weird, right? Because Choristus was already like them jamming off of the ideas of Untilted. So now that they're jamming off of the ideas of Choristus, we are like several steps.
It's very meta.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I mean, what's interesting also is that it sort of lacks, you know, so on one hand, I want to say that Choristus has this kind of exploratory vibe that we talked about. And, you know, we talked about how in the original album, they're pretty succinct, short little pieces, but it's still kind of like the whole project has this kind of searching quality. And obviously you hear a lot more of that in the Versions and the Quadrange EP. I mean, this live set, it sounds incredibly deliberate. Like it is just like a rush to me the whole time. And it feels like it's driving like very deliberately just forward. You know, it's never like pausing to search little, you know, like, 'cause AE Live is always like kind of, oh, let's like, what's in this room over here? Like what's in this corner? But this is just like, let's go, let's go, let's go.
Exactly. Yeah.
And another thing that's weird to me is that the, like, Choristus has this kind of, we talked about it, like, how it sounds like it's in a cave or something. It's, like, very, it's sort of distant. Like, you're sort of straining your ears to hear all the little details in this, like, very lush murk. And the live set is, like, it's missing that. You know what I mean? It's, like, sort of, like, bold and clear. It's, you're hearing Choristus better than you do on the actual album.
Yeah. I wonder, is that just a, you know, a relic of the way this is put together? Because, you know, if you were there in the crowd, obviously you'd hear the sound of the room, you know, the reverb of that room and all. And the actual, like, room recording bootleg of the show is sort of bad quality. So it's hard to, like, tell that. So yeah. I wonder, is it just, like, the soundboard, you know, sort of nature of this, you think?
Well, I don't know, because, you know, I assume that, well, I guess what, you know, we didn't even really talk about this directly, but part of the Choristus project is that they were just jamming and recording, and they talk about how they couldn't manipulate the recordings. Like, they just were what they were. They were stereo recordings, and you couldn't change anything about it, which was sort of different from their usual process and their process to come, where you could, like, mess with anything you want and, like, rearrange, even if it was originally jammed. This was just the stereo recordings, and you can cut them, you can edit them, you can splice them, but that's it, right? So, you know, there's something about that process that just, it does have sort of like a rougher, like, murkiness to it that I actually really dig, like a straight to tape kind of quality.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting in the live set. And of course, we're talking about this, like, crystal clear reconstruction, but it's just interesting how I feel like I'm hearing sounds from Choristus, and there are parts that are just straight up,
yeah,
you know, they're sort of jamming on actual Choristus tracks, but I'm hearing them better than I ever heard them before.
Yeah, I get you. And you mentioned, you know, hearing like actual little snippets of Choristus. That's really neat too. You know, I think people have found that there's little snippets from like NTS and stuff in, or maybe LSEC, like in the AE Live. But I mean, those are just like so giant that it's hard to, like, you know, you have to really be listening for, you know, to find those. But here it's like very, you know, sort of obvious when it happens. And it's really cool because I can't really think of a time I've heard Ottecker like play a song live that you know what I mean?
Yeah, at least not like since like the Incunabula days,
exactly.
Or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, just in summary on that point, I think this set is absolutely fantastic, and it's even better in this reconstruction, which I want to sort of talk about for a second. Now, I mean, what do you make of this whole insane recreation process? I don't know if I have much more to say beyond holy shit, but still.
Yeah, I mean, it's like really amazing. I don't go on that forum, you know, I'm aware of it, but I don't ever go on it. I wonder, you know, I would really like to know exactly like what they did. You know, I'd like to hear from these two people, you know, what the exact process is. Because, I honestly, I don't know, you know, like, did they have to replay what's on the you know, on that bootleg, or and just the sounds are in these files? Because I downloaded those files, but I don't own any of those machines, so I can't open them. So I don't know what's in them. You know what I mean? Like is it the MIDI files? You know, playing it. I like honestly don't understand it whatsoever. You know, that's why.
Yeah.
That's why I thought going into it that it was basically just going to be like someone taking, you know, the sounds of that tour and then, like, you know, making a live set of their kind of own, which didn't sound like that interesting of an idea. But I mean, this is like, you know, if you listen to the actual recording of that show, like, this is like 100% the show you're listening to, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about it to speak to, but we had a listener sort of explain a little bit more detail. And then I was like perusing this, there's like a million pages on this thread where this whole process was like ongoing that I sort of skimmed through. And it just seems like stuff on the Electron machines, you know, you're getting sequence data in addition to all the sound design data and stuff. So that was like really quick and easy to do. But then there are like modular components that were quite hard and I think required like, you know, listening and following. And, you know, that took like years of this like process. So, you know, I think it's just like remarkable how close they get, how exact they get actually. And on that note, I kind of wanted to ask like a philosophical question here. Is this a cover or what is this?
I don't know. I was thinking about that, you know, throughout the week listening to this. And, I almost want to say yeah, but it's also, I mean, like if they are getting like the sequence data and, you know, it's the actual sound files. I mean, it basically, you know, what's the difference in like listening to a recording of an Autechre song or like using those exact machines that they're using and having the, you know, the sequencing files play the song? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Is that really just because, you know, Sean and Rob aren't in the room anymore? Like, does that make it a cover or what? I don't know. I think it is a philosophical question that's yeah. difficult, you know?
It's hard to think about, but I mean, it just is like, it feels like something closer than listening to a cover. Like it feels like,
oh, definitely. You know, 'cause basically
I was originally thinking like, oh, that's kind of fun. And you know, that'll be fun to check out. But as I was listening to it, I was like, I mean, this sounds like, what would I complain about? Like, it sounds exactly like, if you told me that it was a soundboard, I wouldn't have any.
No, it sounds exactly like, like the AE Live record, you know, like the, it sounds just like them. I mean, really, yeah. If I just downloaded this as a live album, I would just think it's a soundboard. I honestly, there's nothing in it that like, I mean, to be honest, it's like one of the best, you know, live albums I've yeah. heard, you know, it's nuts.
It just sounds so good. And it's like, it's basically like Rob and Sean playing, but you just get to hear it in a closer way. I mean, it's just like, it's interesting to think about, but it just, at the end of the day, it's just like awesome to listen to. I want to sort of end just by asking, why do you think Autechre made these files available in the first place? Like, does it tell you anything about Autechre?
I mean, maybe they wanted someone to do this. Maybe it's just, you know, people are, I'm sure, constantly when they play shows live and stuff, I'm sure people are just constantly asking them, like, how do you do that? You know, what equipment, yeah. all this. And so, like, maybe it's like, oh, you know, we've got this show that's 10 years old or whatever. Why not, like, give them the files and, yeah. Let them fuck around? Because really, what are the odds that, like, somebody will have access to all of those machines that were necessary, you know, like you might own one or two or something, but not a ton of people are going to have all, you know, four or five of those things like readily available.
Yeah. I don't know. I just found myself like wondering like what was their goal here? And I mean, it must've been that they thought people would try to do it and that they would have fun playing with it or something, but that, you know, they might've even thought, well, people will pool resources and try to recreate this. And like, is this just the most roundabout way to release a live album possible?
I mean, maybe. You know, it's definitely like the most, you know, digital Autechre sort of way to release a live album. But I mean, you know, yeah. what I was thinking too, like maybe they meant it in a, you know, remix kind of way. Like, you know, yeah. some artists and stuff, like Death Grips released like all the stems, you know, for their first album and stuff and encouraged like remixes. Like maybe it was like sort of Autechre's way to do that, except it's in such like a weird way. Cause like I downloaded the right. files and I own a different Electron machine and I thought, you know, maybe I could open some of them or something, but nope, can't. It's just, they're just yeah. useless sitting on my hard drive.
Yeah. I think you can do it digitally, but I also don't know enough about that.
Yeah, like me neither.
You know, recreations. But, you know, it's just interesting that the Quartzus project is so about process, as we discussed, and then this just caps it off in such a beautiful
yeah,
way.
Yeah, like, that's
this
a good
is
point.
Also, like this weird art project about process and recreation. What is a cover? All that shit. I mean,
yeah, a process live album. That's
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
God damn. Mind blown.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I guess we can move on to the emails then. And let's start with some Chorus's questions. Listener Joe wrote, it sounds like BNC Castle exists purely to troll people who say that Autechre just sounds like a bunch of random computer noise. I remember on one of your previous episodes, someone wrote in about Autechre's sense of humor, and I think it's apparent here more than anywhere else. Also, the fact that they have tracks called No 2, No 4, and No 2-2 is hilarious. You know, we keep circling back to this, but do you hear any of that sense of humor on Choristus?
You know, I don't think something like BNC is just like, you know, quote unquote, to troll somebody. I don't think that, like, I think people who would say to Autechre, you know, like, oh, it's just computer noise, that I feel like those are people they would just sort of be like, you know, they don't get it and move on. I mean, obviously, like, No 2, No 4, No 2-2 is like kind of a joke, and that's pretty hilarious. But I feel like they wouldn't make a song just as like, let's fuck with people who don't listen to Autechre anyways, you know?
Yeah. I mean, just on like a bigger level, I feel like that track is kind of funny. Like, it's absolutely absurd and like,
no, yeah, I agree with that.
Ridiculousness. So I do kind of hear that. You know, maybe not. I feel like Untilted is kind of funny. We talked about how like zany and cartoony it can sound at points.
Yeah.
That to me would be like Autechre's comedy album. But, you know, this one has maybe a couple comedy moments. I do think it's kind of a troll, though, that they called versions because they're all versions.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, like, I agree there.
Everything is versions of each other, and we even like, you know, stumbled over this the whole last episode of like trying to talk about it is hard because like versions is versions of Quadrant.
Yeah,
Quadrant
exactly
is versions of versions.
It's very confusing.
Yeah, I feel like that might have been deliberate. On a similar note, listener Anton writes, I am 99.9% sure Autechre sampled the YouTube classic Keyboard Cat for the song Full 3. The clapping sound that is happening at the start of the song is that beat clapping before the cat starts playing. One argument I have for it is that the video is just half a year older than Choristus. I don't think this is a coincidence. And to be honest, if you were Autechre, wouldn't you just hide jokes in your songs? What do you think about this this bold theory?
You know, I spent longer than I care to admit earlier today. I watched the Keyboard Cat video, which I hadn't seen in you know, years.
First time
and years.
In a long
yeah,
long
first
time.
Time in a long time. Still funny though. and then, you know, listen to Full 3 and damn, I think he might be right. You know, like it's that like little you know, I don't know if it's like supposed to be a snare or a clap, but it's like it almost is the same.
Yeah,
if it's not a sample of that video, I think it's using the same drum machine because it's pretty goddamn close.
I mean, you know, there's like there, you know, people make jokes, right? Like people were joking about God, I can't remember what it's called now, but the like, you know, the track on Plus that has like the clear 808 bell
yeah.
sound.
Mm-hmm.
And they were joke, you know, there were like jokes like, they made it in Max MSP, so it's okay. You know, like,
yeah,
just
yeah.
because they happen to design a sound that sounds exactly like. And the thing is, like, the Keyboard Cat is just using like a standard metronome kind of a beat on whatever shitty keyboard this is. And so maybe they designed like a snare sound. They did so much meticulous, you know, sound design that they ended up going full circle and back at, you know, classic like shitty metronome keyboard sound.
Yeah, just like a Casio generic
yeah.
beat. Yeah,
but I'll be damned if it doesn't if it really doesn't sound like it. I also never appreciated how like brutally lo-fi the Keyboard Cat video is, like
yeah.
it actually sounds kind of awesome, that beat.
It really is. I you know, I hadn't seen it in so long, and I think yeah. it's like it's a really old video. Like it was old before
yeah,
it was on
yeah.
YouTube, I think. It's great. Love a good cat video.
All right, what's next?
All right, another one from listener Joe. When I said that I would love to ask Autechre if they were to do Choristus again, if they would do a longer XI LSEC style release, I wasn't talking about releasing it as one massive blob of music and calling it an album. What I meant was, if they were to do it over again, would they make a 2 to 3 hour album so that included some of the longer versions, for example, IO Mons instead of the original IO, and Chinxy 9X, and have something like a 30-minute version of Parlance that goes through all the different crazy sections that we hear on the various tracks across the all different releases. It seems like they were still pressured to fit on a CD and might have done things differently if they hadn't felt the pressure. But then again, maybe they were totally satisfied with the Choristus project as a whole and wouldn't have felt the desire to do it any differently.
Yeah, this is interesting. I guess I did sort of misinterpret Joe here, that, you know, I thought he was, you know, because we talked about this on the last episode, like, would they have just released it all at once?
Yeah.
But it does seem like they made decisions that would make this whole thing fit on a disc, obviously, right? I mean, it almost fills up the whole disc. And yeah, I mean, it's sort of hard to it's hard to imagine, like, today that they wouldn't give us some longer jams, maybe even if the project was supposed to be a bunch of short little things. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I misinterpreted him during the episode too, but yeah, I think he makes a good point, because you're right. I mean, you know, 2008, you still basically had to release things physically.
Yeah.
You know, Spotify didn't exist or anything, and you know, digital downloads were, you know, in their infancy. But yeah, I mean, today, I think, you know, that's exactly what LSEC, you know, is. You know, it doesn't fit on a CD. It was never released physically, like, in any sort of format. You know, NTS, you know, weirdly, what was released on vinyl. But, you know, I think I could, you know, see, you know, maybe them switching some of the quad range, you know, things around, or, you know, even some of the stuff on versions, you know, if they weren't limited by that, what is it, 80 minutes or 90 minutes of
80,
CD? You know?
80,
yeah. You know, like, I think definitely, you know, that they're in 2008, you know, everyone was limited, you know, by that.
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly disrupt the flow to have a 30-minute track in the middle of there, and it would change a lot about the identity of the album if you did have, like, really wildly different song lengths. But I started thinking, like, well, maybe they would have done, if that was important to them, they could have done, like, 40 tracks, you know, and then, like, some of these other little snippets might have appeared as their own tracks elsewhere if they weren't limited in that way. Here's one more from listener Joe, who says, speaking of the Choruses project as a whole, the question of whether to consider it as a separate release or as one large thing is a very tricky one. On one hand, if you were to do that, then would you need to consider Envain and Sickly Sweet part of Chiastic Slide, or Tri Repete plus plus the true version of the album? On the other hand, I feel like it's a lot more justifiable to consider this all one project, specifically because the other releases are called Choruses Versions and Choruses Quadrange EP AE. It seems like these are meant to be considered part of the same package far more than other albums and related EPs might be. What do you think about that?
He's got a decent point, especially with Tri Repete, you know, plus plus. But I think the fact that, like, you know, the word choristus is in each one of these releases, you know, does, you know, sync them together much more. You know, I think, like, you know, with Tri Repete plus plus, like, you know, Anvil Vapor and Garbage are fairly different from each other and from Tri Repete. It was just America that plus plus was released. I think it was just sort of, you know, a way to release it here, maybe not even their idea. You know, Sickly Sweet, Envain, you know, I think that's maybe closer to being a you know, Choruses sort of thing. You know, especially like Sickly Sweet sort of references, you know, a song on Chiastic and all. Yeah, but I think, like, definitely, like, Choruses, it's much more of, like, a gray area, because we've not only are the titles all the same, but I mean, there's, like, that word again, you know, versions of different songs, like, throughout those three things. You know, you're getting many versions of the same tract and stuff, which makes it much harder to, like, separate.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It just seems like usually Odd-Tekker's EPs are, like, just different paths, like, totally, to me. You know, they just sound like they're different ideas and directions, like, really usually unified in some way. Whereas, you know, I don't think you could listen to, like, Choruses Versions and be like, this is so clearly different with its own unique identity from Choruses. And again, I do think the title, you know, sort of encourages you to do that. Not to mention, like, in some of the quotes we read in the Ask Odd-Tekker Anything, where they're sort of saying, like, yeah, go ahead, make your own playlist and stuff. That's kind of what we were shooting for. All right, what's next?
All right, yeah, listener David, he says, Choruses is not a weak album by any means, with more great material to come, but ended what for me would be their imperial phrase, which was the high bar that ran from Tri Repete through Untilted. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess he means,
oh, yeah, phase. Yeah, that's what made me stumble.
Yeah, I just sort of copied it directly. But I kept thinking about this term, imperial phase, and, you know, it's interesting because if I had to pick, you know, I don't know fully what that means, imperial phase, but for some reason I, like, have some sense of, like, okay, if I had to choose an Odd-Tekker imperial phase, I would probably not go as far as Untilted, but I would probably say that like kind of tri-repete through Confield era. Do you have any sense of like what you would, like how you would define Imperial phase and what it would be?
Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult because I, you know, I think we've been talking about like this being like the middle period and all. So I think there's definitely like, you know, different phases, but you know, Imperial phase, I guess, implies the their best time. And, you know, I don't spoil anything, but I kind of think we're living in the, you know, the best time now. And also, I don't know
what. See, I was interpreting it differently, like not like best, but just like their world takeover, like their domination period or something like that.
Okay.
And it feels to me like the stuff they're doing now is like for them, like they're just kind of like doing whatever the fuck they want. And they don't even care if anybody likes it. They're so established that they can just kind of like chase whatever they want. But there was like this time in the 90s where they were maybe like deliberately trying to change the face of electronic music or something like that. And that it was sort of a takeover stage, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that makes sense, you know, more. Yeah. I guess, I mean, I'm tempted to even say, you know, maybe Amber through, I don't know, Confield or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Just seems like they're not interested anymore in like what's going on in popular music or like even speaking to that or having an effect on it.
Yeah.
On a slightly related note, listener Sean writes, I would have to strongly disagree with Dan's point on the Untilted episode that you could potentially group Choristus in as a quadrilogy with Confield Draft and Untilted. Yeah. Now that we sort of did the deep dive on Choristus, what do you think a little differently about that?
Did I say that? I don't remember.
Yeah, just that like you sort of grouped it in with the middle period, like these are the middle period albums.
I think we touched on it very slightly on the last episode, but I think that Choristus is sort of the like, it's sort of like a in between period, in between the middle and in between, you know, the current, you know, contemporary period of Autechre. I never really meant it as like a quadrilogy, which I think like implies, you know, that there's something similar about all those. I just sort of meant it as like, this is part of the period. But I think after spending so much time with the whole, you know, Choristus extended universe that it is hard to group in with that middle period. And it's definitely like making a change into another era. As I've been spending, you know, time with Oversteps and Move of 10, I think it's sort of like breaking me from that more. You know, we'll get to it more next episode. Yeah. But I don't know if I think that's the middle period anymore, but I'm not sure where I would put it. I think it's maybe sort of a floating, you know, in between.
Yeah, it kind of is, but it's also like, it feels to me much more like the, like a sign of things to come than connected to this, but it doesn't fit exactly right. I think the next email is on a similar topic, so why don't you read that?
Yeah, this comes from listener Stylus. He said, I think there's a tendency among fans to view the three albums that follow Confield as less impactful extensions of it, which is a real shame. While I do think that applies to Draft 730 to an extent, I feel that Untilted and Choristus stand perfectly alone from the Confield wave, or whatever you might call it.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I can't even make up my mind. Does it seem to you like Draft and Untilted, you're a little less hot on them than I am, are kind of just in the shadow of Confield?
I think maybe a little bit. You know, like I said, I'm not super hot on Untilted. You know, it's good. It's just sort of maybe not for me. It's hard for me to say that it's in the shadow of Confield, because I think even if Confield didn't exist, I'd feel the same way about it. But yeah, I don't know. It just sort of like, I do sort of think that the grouping those all together as this middle period, like I've done and like we've done, is a little unfair. It just sort of feels like you have to do it, you know, to talk about it maybe.
Yeah, I guess for some reason it's weird because it does feel like this is kind of the middle period, and it just feels like Untilted has like very little to do with Draft or Choristus, right? Mm-hmm. And Choristus has like very little to do with, you know, Untilted. It just feels like each of the albums in this period is sort of like a completely different thing. You know, Draft is disappointing because it feels like half it's trying to like continue doing the Confield thing and half it's like totally reeling back from that, like going back into maybe LP5 territory or something.
Yeah.
Or EP7 territory a little bit, but it's like you know, that's why to me it's unsuccessful. But it's like, for some reason, I want to group all of these records together because they have so little to do with each other, is maybe how I feel. You know, you brought up something I actually wanted to get to. We got an email from listener Rob who said, thanks for turning me on to Untilted 15 years later, straight to my top four Autechre LPs. Love to hear that. Really distinctive, he says. Knowing there is one outstanding LP and that gap between Confield and XI really lifts the whole corpus for me, takes my admiration for these guys up yet another notch. I was kind of curious to get your take on this because for me, like, Draft is the one misstep, but because you aren't so hot on Draft or Untilted, do you feel like, you know, the sort of the middle of their career is like a little bit of a slump, like a larger slump, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I sort of do, you know, before doing this podcast, I like would have said that it was, you know, very clearly the slump, you know, but digging into it, I said that I really came to like love Choristus and, you know, the whole extended universe of Choristus, which I think, you know, took it out of that slump a bit. But Draft feels like a slump record to me, you know, for what you just said. It's the first album that feels like they're not taking some, you know, big step. It kind of feels like either just a continuation of Confield mixed with, you know, a little backstep into the LP5 kind of thing. Untilted, I don't feel the same about. I like understand that record. It's just like I always want to say, like, it's just sort of not for me. It's not the, you know, kind of electronic music I want to hear. But I don't feel that it's a, you know, like a step back like I do with Draft. So I would kind of say that it's easy to group like that middle period as a slump. But then again, if you put Confield in that, I like Confield a lot. And, you know, I put it fairly high on you know, our rankings that we've been doing. So it's hard, you know, it's hard to say it's a slump. But I mean, the thing is like Autechre as a whole, they don't have any like awful albums, you know, from all the records, you know, of their whole thing. I think like the lowest score I'd give any of them is, you know, pretty high. And so, you know, when you say it's a slump, you know, it's not, it's like, oh, you know, that wasn't a 10, it was only an 8, you know, kind of thing. It's being a little nitpicky.
Yeah. Well, here's a related email from listener Alex who says, surprised to hear Confield through Untilted being characterized as a sort of Dark Ages middle period. In my conception, Confield has always towered as the definitive AE record, with Untilted as its sort of more accessible companion piece. Only Draft fits the Dark Ages characterization for me. I confess I'd never made it through the whole thing until this podcast. It's just funny because it does feel like there's just something so weird about Confield that it feels like this hard break from everything they had done before. Mm-hmm. And then there seems to be like a lot of searching afterwards of like, that's why they're so different. Let's try this totally different thing. Let's try this totally different thing. It's like Confield has this weird, very disruptive effect, I think, in their discography, which is like, you know, I love Untilted. I love Choristus, as we've seen, but there's something about them like not exactly, you know what I'm, it's just seeming a little bit lost, like, and just trying lots of different things, and some for better, some for worse.
No, exactly. I mean, I think what you just said is perfect. You know, Confield like is like that sort of clean break. I think, you know, moving from like Incunabula to Amber, Trirepitae, you know, those records are different from each other, but it still sounds like, you know, the same kind of group. You know, you can see where, you know, those all came from the same people. You know, Confield, I think, like, really is a big, you know, turn, you know, they're really turning the corner and becoming something else. And I think, you know, Draft especially shows that, like, maybe it got them a little, I don't want to say lost, but it's just sort of like, it, maybe they felt like they had to do a clean break every time now, or what, you know, it's hard to say. To what he said about the you know, Dark Ages sort of thing, the only record I would consider like a Dark Ages, and even then I don't think it's like horrible or unlistenable or anything, is Draft. I mean, really my chief complaint with it is that it's not groundbreaking like the rest of, you know, like if Confield didn't exist, I think Draft would be pretty good. It's just it's just disappointing, like, in an artistic sense, I feel like.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, actually, that you said about, like, they do seem to, like, feel like they need to make a clean break every time for a little bit. And it's actually, to me, really refreshing. I mean, I love Untilted, but I like you know, I like that they decided to stick with that and build off of it for Choristus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of like, let's totally switch it up.
It sort of feels like, and maybe that's a good reason not to put Choristus in that middle period, because it does sort of seem like that's the time when they, you know, make this decision, like, we don't have to be, you know, we don't have to make this, you know, 180 degree turn every record. You know, we could sort of take the you know, building blocks of the previous thing and build on it, which I think is what, like, they did before Confield, you know.
And in the 2010s is like,
exactly.
That is the thing.
No, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I think that's like an okay. I think that's what, like, you know,
I love it.
Normal
I love
people it. Do, you know?
Yeah. 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 Here's another just quick, intriguing comment from Alex, who says, it's always weird to hear y'all call them songs. To me, they're tracks, which feels closer to capturing the weird manufactured quality the AE excels at so much. What do you think? Is it weird to call them songs?
You know, I always sort of do think about that, like with, you know, experimental music in general. I tend to like refer to like experimental music as like pieces, you know, sort of like classical music sort of thing, because I think like the word song does sort of imply like a you know, a pop music kind of thing, you know, like a popular you know, kind of thing, but also, you know, potato, you're just sort of also, does anyone actually say potato? I've never heard anybody say that.
No, but nobody does. I don't know where
yeah, that's a stupid comment, but I mean, tracks, I understand what he means by tracks, because honestly, yeah, electronic music, I think the word tracks is probably better, but
yeah
I just sort of use it
probably
as interchangeably.
It's probably problematic. It's probably like a you know, rockist attitude, but there's something about the word songs that feels like dismissive, like it is small and disposable.
It does. It seems disposable. That's
exactly. But that's not true, right? Like, we know that's not true about pop music anyway. All right. What's the next one?
All right. Listener Daniel, which is not me. What are your guys' thoughts on Scruffy's ratings on Autechre releases? His highest ratings are an 8/10 for Incunabula and an 8/10 for Chiastic Slide, with his lowest ratings being a 4.5/10 for Sign. I know he's a contentious and controversial figure in the music world, but sometimes I'm fascinated by his thoughts on discographies that I enjoy.
I too am fascinated by him sometimes. I mean, what I like about him is that he, you know, his whole project is like the history of music or something, and it's like what he's interested in is like, does this change music, or like, does it, you know, change the world? Like, not, you know, not every great album has to change the world, I think, but if that's your standard, then that's kind of an interesting and new way to rate music. He also has a tendency to choose like pretty left field picks. You know, it'll be like some iconic artist, and it's like a pretty weird choice of the album that he picks as like the best, their greatest contribution to the world of music. But on that note, I mean, the problem with him is that he seems to think that every artist has like one great contribution to make. And it's very rare that more than one album gets like a pretty solid rating. I mean, it's surprising that he gives both Incunabula and again, one of those weird picks, Chiastic Slide, the two highest ratings here. But you know what I mean? So it's like, you got to take it with a grain of salt. It's nice to listen to like the weird left ball. You know, if you had not given Chiastic Slide serious treatment and then you were reading Scruffy, you might be like, hey, maybe I ought to check that out. And you would be, he would be right. That's an amazing album. But you know what I mean? He, like, the problem is that he thinks that artists can't really do it more than once or twice.
Yeah, I don't really like him that much, you know. I'll read some of the stuff every now and then, and like, you know, back in the day when I used to hang out on Mew and stuff, you know, he would come up and I would read it and stuff. But he just sort of feels like a contrarian and like an asshole, you know. Frankly, you know, like, because like you said, he. I wish I had an example off the top of my head, but, you know, he's not going to pick, you know, frequently he won't pick the most famous album or like, you know,
right.
with the Beatles or something. I might be wrong, but I bet Sgt. Pepper isn't his highest one, or even Revolver. So, you know, it's probably it's probably Meet the Beatles or something. You know?
Like, I think he quite famously shits all over the Beatles as a rule. Which, that's classic contrarian right there.
Exactly.
You know, and it's annoying, but sometimes you like a contrarian because they do make you listen to something you otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, I mean, he has some viewpoints that are worth, you know, hearing every now and then. Cause you're right. I mean, with his, you know, Autechre ratings, I think, you know, like Chiastic Slide is a great album, and it is one that sort of kind of gets, you know, thrown to the wayside sometimes. So it is nice, you know, like maybe somebody will discover Chiastic Slide because of this contrarian view. But I just think overall he's sort of, he's sort of annoying.
All right. Well, listener Steve wrote us a fantastically long and detailed email with a theory on why AE pushed everything so hard in terms of the angular dissonance of Confield melodies through the bonkers beats on Draft and Untilted, which I'll try to summarize. Essentially, Steve suggests that the way IDM was blowing up in the early aughts was a bit irksome to AE, and that they were kind of trying to throw copycats like Radiohead off their trail and to reintroduce this kind of fuck you punk attitude to the genre, or to restore that fearless experimental edge. I mean, I feel like this is an interesting point because we kept talking about this, how like Autechre's influence was becoming very felt and everywhere, and how hard it is to keep moving. Do you think anything about like the kind of wild bonkers quality of some of the records in this period are like a deliberate, you know, try copying that, Radiohead?
Kind of not, you know, and maybe this is just my own, you know, feelings about them, but like Sean and Rob kind of seem like nice, cool guys. They don't really seem like dickheads that much. You know, cause like there's the famous, like, you know, Aphex Twin who does seem like a dickhead.
Right.
You know, like saying he hates Radiohead or something, you know, after Kid A or, you know, whatever.
Right.
They just seem like maybe they're like, oh, you know, people are catching up. We gotta, you know, step our game up or something. I don't think it's like a fuck you Radiohead kind of thing. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it they just don't seem like that, you know.
I do get a little sense, because we talked about this, like with I'm totally like adding this myself, this is just my headcanon, but I just feel like there's a little rivalry going on between like Aphex Twin and Autechre specifically, and that they are kind of challenging each other sometimes, like top that,
you know, oh yeah, Richard, what was what they call the going back and forth with the
tricks war.
A tricks war. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, not totally serious, but I do feel like there was a little friendly competition in the IDM world.
Definitely.
And so they may have felt that about people like Bjork or Radiohead or whatever the case is. It's possible. What's next?
All right, yeah. Listener Steve, which is a different Steve, if Autechre hadn't already proved themselves in the 90s and acquired an audience in a well-known record label pushing them, would anyone listen to any of the AE releases of the last 20 years? Or would they listen to the to them more than once? If any of these records, Confield, Draft 730, Untilted, etc., were the first release of a new artist or maybe a self-release on Bandcamp, I doubt the records would have the following that they do.
Yeah. This is interesting because it is impossible, I think, to conceive of a world where Autechre never existed, you know, like, because their influence, I think, is so massive on people like Radiohead and Bjork. And, you know, like, I've been thinking a lot about like Sophie, right, who just passed away, like, I mean, so sadly, but she was obviously a huge Autechre fan. It's like so, it's so tragic for some reason, just as me as an Autechre fan, that like, it's clear that, you know, that Autechre remix just came out recently, and you know she must have been so thrilled about that. And then, oh my God. But anyway, like, I mean, her influence on the hyperpop genre is immense, and she's clearly like so inspired by Autechre. So it's just like, I can't even conceive of a world of popular music without Autechre's fingerprints on it to then guess what would people think about this music coming out now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. I think Autechre is really one of those sort of things that, you know, they do like sort of have their fingers on so many things, but it's not like you know, overtly so, you know. It's drifted down through, like, you know, more popular artists, you know, like Radiohead or something. I think, you know, your average, you know, person who just, you know, likes Radiohead because they heard it on the radio or whatever doesn't know about Autechre, but, you know, the influence is still there and stuff. I think, like, what he said, like, if this was, you know, if Confield was somebody on Bandcamp's, you know, first record, I think it probably would just get lost, basically because there is, like, a deluge of, like, records that get released every day on Bandcamp. And I'm sure, like, I'm sure, and sometimes at like bothers me that I'm sure there are like some of the best records I've ever, you know, that you could ever hear that right, you'll just right. never hear because it's just some guy made it in his bedroom and he doesn't have anybody, you know, pushing it and nobody listens to it. And so it never gets discovered. I think that, yeah, without a label and stuff, like, I think it would definitely be harder for them and everything, you know, to not. I think too what he's saying, like having that grounding of like some of those 90s records that were like big, kind of gives like the experimental stuff, you know, maybe a bigger audience than it would have had, you know, if they started there.
Yeah,
it's true, but I mean, I don't think it speaks to like the quality of Autechre at all. I think it's
no,
you know, it's not like I don't like Confield just because, you know, they made Tri Repete, like
right.
I probably heard Confield because, you know, they got famous, you know, because of,
well, I mean, that's just the case, is like they were so hugely influential in the 90s that like now they can coast, like
exactly
you're just saying, like
exactly.
Now they can just do their own thing, they can explore, and they've got like this solid fan base that's always going to listen to everything they do, and they just so happen to be like constantly making great new material and like pushing forward. But they do seem to like establish their reputation and other fans are going to be with them forever. But it's just like, I would have to imagine a world where like Kid A doesn't exist and where Homogenic doesn't exist.
Yeah,
and like maybe Sophie doesn't exist. And then maybe if I did hear Confield today, I would be like, holy fucking shit.
You yeah, know, like, no, exactly.
So who knows? Let's see. Steve also writes, with respect to a user comment about speaking about history for each release, you guys talked about U.S. politics or U.S. news and U.S. Billboard top hits, which doesn't make a lot of sense. Major events that happened in England would be more pertinent to Autechre. They are not a U.S. act. Yeah, that's true. Fair enough. But I feel like, one, I was trying to kind of just pick a few like big world events as a whole. But two, I think we were mostly just testing it to show that it might not make even any sense at all to talk about cultural context that much.
Yeah, I think we were, as the Brits say, I think we were just kind of taking the piss a little bit. but yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, we were being sort of U.S. centric, I guess. But I mean, that's where I live, so.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that much about English culture in the 90s or like what was going on. But you know, if anybody wants to write in with that stuff that they were thinking about that was influencing the way they were listening to these records, I would love to hear it. Steve also gave us some detailed breakdowns of major developments in electronic music and music distribution. You know, I just sort of copied the list into our little doc here, and I wonder if anything comes to mind looking at it. But I feel like these are the kind of things we actually do talk about, which is like, you know, the CD era, the digital era, you know, like the portable era, the Spotify era we're going to start talking about now. These are certainly important because they are really first and foremost, I think, a lot of times on Autechre's mind.
Yeah, I mean, Autechre like clearly is like a, and I think all, you know, electronic music, you, like when you're using technology to make music, you sort of like have to be in the forefront of technology, like as it progresses and stuff. You know, it would be weird if, you know, Autechre was, you know, stuck in the past kind of thing, you know, like, you know, resisting Spotify or resisting, you know, Bandcamp kind of digital releases. So I think, you know, they always like, I mean, we talked about it with some of the, you know, Quaristus and everything, like they really are like kind of pushing the format with everything. I mean,
right.
I think LSEC is like really one of the first releases where people said, you know, the length no longer matters, you know, like
right,
that,
right.
Why be bound to that, you know, any longer at all? You know, and I think Autechre, again, is very much at the forefront of a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, that, I mean, I liked getting this breakdown, but that's stuff that I do feel like we've been talking about and that we will continue to talk about. What's next? A lot of emails here. This is what happens when we skip a listener email episode.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, listener Jordan, he says, I've been thinking about how good Tri Repete works as a teacher for making electronic music because of how straightforward the approach of the album is. It is an album that shows you how creative you can be with the simple ideas and how simple music doesn't have to sound boring. It is an album that is repetitive, but it shows you how to be creative within that repetition. The tracks are just loops with parameters that change over time. Even the album title sounds like it's telling you to have a go yourself by saying, try repeating this. That's good. I never thought of that. And, and listening to it makes me want to. It is a good album to ease someone into making electronic music and makes it easier for new people to understand basic concepts and making the craft more approachable. I can see how the album can be influential to electronic musicians, even if they want to make something that is sonically different.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing point, actually. First off, I never thought of the album title in that way, which is great. But also, I remember feeling kind of inspired in this way when I first listened to it, because it's like, yeah, just start with one loop, right? And just start adding to it. Like, it's almost like teaches you how to make like electronic music and how to make music out of repetition and simplicity. And, you know, I remember like messing around with this stuff as soon as I heard like this album in particular. It was just like, all right, I don't have to like construct some like, you know, intricate like crystal globe like Aphex Twin does or Boards of Canada or something. Like, I'll just start with one sound, one loop that's interesting. I'll add a new one to it. I'll add a new one to it. And it's like, not everybody's going to do it with the talent that Autechre does, but it might explain why this album is so influential, that it sort of teaches you how to make music.
No, I mean, exactly. I mean, I bootlegged Fruity Loops around the time, mm-hmm. you know, I heard Try Repete, and I'd made some really, you know, shitty electronic music that was definitely I felt inspired by, you know, that record and stuff. And I mean, even today, like the stuff I make and stuff, I'm constantly inspired by that Autechre thing of just repeating thing, you know, the whole, you know, minimalism and everything of it is, you know, definitely inspiring.
All right, well, lastly, we've gotten a lot of emails over the whole course of the show, actually, asking us to talk about Autechre's collaborations with the Hafler Trio, and we're definitely gonna, but what is this new rumor about a box set, Dan?
Yeah, I posted it on our Twitter if anyone wants to check it out, but it seems like it's also on the Autechre subreddit, but it seems like this record label is gonna re-release all the Autechre Hafler Trio releases before, but on vinyl over seven discs. So that should be cool if that actually comes out. It said March of 2021. So if that's legitimate, that'll be cool. Hopefully it makes those releases more accessible. It means of finding it, because those aren't on Spotify, and one of them is like a DVD. So it's hard to it's kind of hard to, I mean, you could download it places, but you know, it's nowhere. I don't think you can like legitimately, you know, buy those anywhere anymore. Like, I don't think you know, even the digital downloads or anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, that would be like really exciting and cool. But we will talk about the Autechre's collaborative work after we get through the main discography. We'll talk about Gescom. We'll talk about remixes. We're gonna talk about everything that so many of you have been requesting. But all right, we made it through the emails.
All right. Well, if you've got any Autechre opinions or hot takes to share, we want to hear them. Email skunkcastpod@gmail.com. Next episode, less than a week, we're going over Steps and Move of 10. Again, send us your thoughts on those. Gunkcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out. Subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Look us up YouTube. Stay connected on Twitter, Instagram. Those are @gunkcastpod. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.